welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 72, Admiral Nelson of the British Navy. Before we begin, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that if you'd like to support our podcast, please check out patreon.com/Generals and Napoleon. If you'd like to support our podcast in other ways, please go to Spotify, Amazon, Apple, or wherever podcasts are heard, and give us a review or rating. We appreciate your assistance. Now, on with the show. Gracious enough to join us, Evan Wilson from the United States Naval War College. Say hello, Evan.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So we are going to talk about probably other than Napoleon and the Duke of Wellington, maybe even amongst those three, the most interesting guy from the era in Admiral Nelson, correct?
I'm just glad to see an admiral on your Generals and Napoleon podcast. To be honest.
Right. This is my first admiral, I think, that I've had on. So, yeah, we make the foray into naval tactics and warfare. So thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. If you're not familiar with Evan, in addition to being a professor at the Naval War College, he also has a few books that I highly recommend. There's one out right now called The Horrible Peace. It's a book about British veterans post Waterloo, but really starts around 1812. Correct, Evan?
That's right. I try to start the story as the wars begin to end and carry it for about a decade after the wars.
Okay. And we can find this book on Amazon or anywhere books are sold, correct?
That's right.
All right. And Evan's been on other podcasts. And yeah, we're going to talk about the famous Horatio Nelson today. And yeah, let's kick off and I guess depart from our moorings.
Very good.
Yeah. See what I did there? He was born in September 1758 in Norfolk, England. He's the sixth of 11 children to Edmund Nelson and his wife, Catherine Suckling. I don't know a whole lot about his early life. Was it an aristocratic family?
Not really. His father's a clergyman, so he's a country parson. Nothing very exciting about it. His mom's family is related. He's cousin to the Walpoles, so he has some connections on that side, and that becomes important in his career later. But no, he's a son of a clergyman. If you've ever been to Burnham Thorpe in Norfolk, it's not much to write home about. It's pasture land and goes right up to the ocean. It's brackish. He's born very close to the sea, but not in one of the more picturesque parts of the country, let's say.
Got it. And I think this is going to be interesting because he does work his way basically to the top, kind of like Napoleon did, without a whole lot of, I should say, support or I guess doors open for him when he started off.
Yeah. His mom died when he was nine. So his dad had eight children and not much money. So the Navy was a good choice, and he was able to leverage his mother's family connections to get his career started. So he joins the Reis Anabla in 1771, and the captain of that ship is Captain Maurice Suckling, who is his uncle.
Okay. Yeah, I found that interesting. He begins his naval career in 1771, and he suffers from chronic seasickness throughout his life. So that seems like an odd career choice then to me, that he joined the Navy. Is that accurate?
Well, I think any sailor will tell you that everyone gets seasick if it's rough enough. So it's true, not to overstate the significance of that. Mm-hmm. But I think, certainly he does suffer from seasickness and occasionally at very inopportune times. So that's not the ideal trait of a naval officer. But nevertheless, I don't think it's so bad that he can't, he can't function on a ship or anything like that. So,
right.
And it doesn't deter him from a career at sea when he first joins.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the HMS Reginald Bob. What was his early career like? It seems to be a truly global experience where he's seeing the world first in the East and West Indies.
Yeah, it's remarkable how far he travels in his young career. So the Reis Anabla was mobilized to deal with the Falklands crisis with Spain in 1770-71, but that doesn't end up becoming a war. So His uncle realizes that if he's going to pursue a career in the Navy, he needs to get more sea time. And so he sends him on a West Indiaman, which is commanded by one of Suckling, the uncle's former petty officers. And that's pretty unusual in terms of early naval career for men of his generation. Not entirely unusual, but certainly not something that everybody was able to do. And then in 1773, he managed to get himself on a different ship, which was headed to the North Pole. They didn't make it that far, but they're looking for an ice-free passage up there. And so they end up north in Norway, and Nelson has a famous encounter with the polar bear where he was, on the ice away from the ship he wasn't supposed to be. And there's some funny prints of him about to smack a polar bear in the face with the butt end of a musket, which is probably not what happened. Probably instead he saw the polar bear and ran away, as any sane person would do when they see a polar bear. But then he comes back in October 73 and ends up in the East Indies. So yeah, he's covered about, two thirds of the globe there in just his first 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Basically a teenager at this point, he's seen a lot already.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big empire, the British Empire, especially after the 7 Years' War, when they've captured Canada and India from the French. So the Navy's what stitched the empire together, right, through the sea lines of communication. And therefore, it's not too surprising that we would see an officer who would, or a future officer who would spend a lot of time on those routes. But yeah, if you're comparing him to his contemporaries, he probably got more global experience faster than most.
Yeah, and he works his way up the ranks to be a midshipman, basically starting point for an officer. How fast or slow was the upper mobility for British naval officers at this time?
So it's first important to note that even though Nelson starts as an ordinary seaman, no one on board the ship would have identified him as such. Mm-hmm. So the muster book said that he was an ordinary seaman, but everybody knew that he was the captain's nephew.
Got it.
And they would have marked him out as a future officer. What was in the muster book had to do with the requirements for passing the lieutenant's exam. So at this stage, everybody who wanted to be eligible for a commission as a lieutenant had to pass a written and oral exam, mm-hmm. In order to qualify for a lieutenant, which is not something that the British Army ever had to do. So this is different from the Army experience. So you had to pass this exam, and in order to be eligible to sit the exam, you had to have 6 years of sea time.
Mm.
At least two of those, you had to be rated as a midshipman. So what his uncle is doing is basically trying to get him sea time and then also find time to rate him as a midshipman. And that is more of a bureaucratic thing than it is. And it doesn't necessarily, you can't tell from what's in the book what Nelson's responsibilities would have been on board, because it depended on how old he was, how skilled he was, how much experience he had, what kind of ship his captain ran. So his early career is pretty typical. And that 6 years that it takes him to go from his first experience at sea until he passes the exam is exactly in line with what most other officers were doing.
Got it. Well, I know in the British Army, especially if you're a noble, you could buy your promotions pretty quickly up to lieutenant colonel, in a fast way. And I just wasn't sure if the Navy was a similar way.
Right. You can't purchase a commission in the Navy. That's a major distinction between the two services. So Nelson has to serve sea time like everybody else. He has to be rated as midshipman like everybody else. He's got to pass the exam like everybody else. Whether you passed or failed the exam, there are a lot of different things that could influence that. It's better to think about it like a driver's test.
Mm.
If you pass the lieutenant's exam, that does not mean you're a brilliant sailor, but you had to show that you were capable of the basics, at least.
Right.
Just like you wouldn't necessarily think all 16-year-olds are good drivers. You'd say, at least the 16-year-old has a basic understanding of the rules of the road and how to get the car from A to B.
Right, right. Well, it's not long before he gets his first taste of command during the American Revolutionary War. How did he perform, and was there anything that made him stand out from the pack early on? Like, did people say, oh, wow, this guy's really going to be a talented commander one day?
Initially, no. Mm-hmm. Initially, what made him stand out from the pack was that his uncle had become the controller of the Navy, which is the head of basically the shore infrastructure. And so the commander-in-chief in the West Indies, which is where he's stationed in the American War, thinks, this guy's uncle is an important person in the naval hierarchy. I should keep him close to me. And so he moves him to the flagship. This is Peter Parker, soon after Nelson arrives on the station. After that, by all accounts, Parker identified that this guy actually knew what he was doing. And the Admiral quickly recognized that Nelson was his own man and was on the up and up. So, and in fact, his uncle died just a year after he became controller. So the importance of the connection quickly went away. But in December of 1778, Nelson became the commander of a brig, the Badger, which was patrolling, I think, in Nicaragua. And then he's promoted to a captain in June of 1779. And so that's, he's 21 years old at that point. And that is a rapid rise because the way the British naval ranks worked, you had to have 6 years before you could pass for lieutenant. But after that, you could be promoted very quickly, either because of your talent or because of your connections or because of good luck or some combination of them, commander, and then from commander to captain. Once you made post captain, you couldn't be promoted to admiral until unless by seniority. So it was only by seniority after that. So basically the rapid rise of Nelson in the West Indies in the American War is, I wouldn't say completely unusual, but it is, he's promoted very quickly into a position of authority so that by 21, he's gone as high in the Navy as he can get on his own merit.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, but he's not, you know, Lord Nelson as we know him yet. He hasn't had the spectacular victories, but he's, and like you mentioned, he becomes captain in 1781. He's commanding the Albemarle. And did he have that giant personality yet? Like, what was it like to serve under him?
So he's basically the opposite of Wellington, is a good way to think about it. So where Wellington was aloof and distant and a hard guy to sort of get to become friends with or get to know, Nelson was the opposite. He was friendly with pretty much everybody. He was famous for knowing the names of all the men on his ship and greeting them. He's approachable. And by all accounts, this has been this was true of him for his whole life. So the young captain, he was known for his what became later known as the Nelson touch. And so, you know, Nelson was somebody that his men tended to, in almost all cases, worship as a very talented and amiable and fair-minded commander. So, he's definitely somebody that that you'd want to work for.
Yeah, he seems very gregarious and outgoing, and he kind of reminds me of Marshal Ney, and just utterly fearless. Like his troops loved his sailors loved serving under him and wanted to go the extra mile for him.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good comparison.
So moving on to his personal life, in 1785, he meets his future wife, Frances Fanny Nelson, and they're married 2 years later. What was that marriage like? I've heard it was kind of up and down.
Yeah, it's always hard to know how other people's marriages actually were. But, you know, when the two of them meet on Nevis in the West Indies, Fanny's husband had just died and she had a young son named Josiah. And apparently Josiah and Nelson sort of hit it off underneath the table at a party once. And that's how he and Fanny met. So it, you know, sort of a meet cute situation.
Right.
And they seem after Fanny and Horatio seem to have been sort of happy enough. As far as we can tell, they were childless. So Fanny had a kid with her previous husband, but didn't have one with Nelson.
Right.
So, you know, the marriage, we can talk a lot more about it when we get to the section on Naples, but certainly the marriage broke down. Certainly the marriage collapsed and in recriminations and bad feelings and all the rest of it. And Nelson was to a large degree responsible for that. But early on, it's hard to say much about the marriage other than it seems like it was probably okay, at least for the first 10 years or so. Yeah. And after that, it clearly was not.
Yeah, and he was away a lot, so that probably didn't help anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 1793, he's serving in the Mediterranean Sea. So again, a new theater, but you know he's all over the world, as we mentioned. And he's involved in the invasion of Corsica, which is Napoleon's home island. This is another campaign that I would say had its ups and downs. How did that go?
Yeah, it's interesting. Nelson had a sort of diplomatic role in that campaign. He spent a lot of time detached from the main British force, trying to shore up allied efforts against Republican French forces all over the Western Mediterranean. It's a campaign that a lot of historians are sort of revisiting lately because It's clear that the British left a lot of opportunities on the table, and that the failure of the Allied coalition against the French was to some degree Britain's fault. So they're trying to sort of re-examine the campaign. But Nelson's role was basically to try to shore up the Allied support. And it, yeah, like you said, ups and downs. So he leads the blockade of Corsica in 1794 and cooperates with Pasquale Paoli and his Corsican patriots, and saw a lot of action there. Actually, he goes ashore an awful lot. The reputation of the British army at this period is at a very low ebb. And so most of the naval officers don't think that the army officers that are deployed with them know at all what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to take action on their own. And so a lot of naval officers spend time like leading, you know, marine detachments ashore and doing shore raids and that sort of stuff. And in one of those actions, Nelson was wounded in the face by stones that were thrown up from a shot, and he lost the sight in his right eye. He didn't wear a patch or anything like that, but he definitely couldn't see very well out of it. And then in 1795, the criticism is that his commander at the time, Hotham, was far too timid, and Nelson was very dissatisfied with him. But then there's a new commander in chief after that in January 1796, who's John Jarvis. And he and Nelson immediately hit it off because Jarvis is much more aggressive and ready to sort of take the action to the enemy. So it's I think that's a good characterization. An up and down few years in the Mediterranean, some successes, but some wounds and some frustrations as well.
Right. And I think like any young commander, you're learning what works and what doesn't. And, you know, Napoleon didn't win every one of his battles starting off. You know, you learn some things.
Yeah, it is interesting. He's young. He's also senior. Both of those things are true. So he's, you know, just, I guess, in the 1790s, he would be trying to do math in public here, you know, in his 30s, basically. But so he's not that old, but he's been a post captain for, you know, all the way back to the American War. So He's getting into some senior leadership positions, and we'll see in a second when he gets promoted to admiral. But I think this is his first taste of a proper European war, and it's all gone wrong. And the Republican French forces are clearly in command of the Mediterranean by the time the campaign ends.
Yeah. And let's talk about that real briefly. Were the captains, post captains and admirals supposed to be out on the deck leading the fight, or are they supposed to be far away from the battle, just kind of coordinating it?
But by the nature of ships, they are right smack in the middle. There's nowhere else for them to go because
right.
The platform moves and they carry them with it. So you are always in the line of fire whenever your ship is in action, no matter who you are.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of flattens the risk. Everybody on the ship is at risk. So what a captain was expected to do in action was to stand on the quarterdeck and to direct the action and to, you know, give orders about the sails and the guns and which direction the wheel and all those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But often by the time you actually got into a proper fight with another ship, there weren't many more orders to give. And so your job was to stand there and to be courageous and basically show your men that you weren't afraid and that you were there to take the risks that they were also taking while they were firing the guns.
Yeah. Lead by example. Yeah.
Right. I guess.
Well, in 1797, we still find him serving in the Med, and he performs well at the Battle of Cape St. Vincent against the Spanish Navy, despite disobeying orders. Is this when he becomes admiral?
This is one of the great myths of Nelson's career. So he didn't actually disobey orders.
Okay.
And I won't get too far into the tactical weeds, but you do need to understand a couple things about how the battle actually goes. So the British are heavily outnumbered. This is the British squadron under John Jarvis, who I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Heavily outnumbered by the Spanish. But the Spanish are split into two groups. There's a convoy that the Spanish are trying to escort, and that's where the origin of the fighting comes from. And the British end up in between the two groups of Spanish ships. But the Spanish don't just like take that. They actually respond, of course, to the British moves and end up turning to sort of chase the British squadron. And the easiest way to think about it is that the two squadrons would have ended up chasing each other's tail and never actually properly engaging with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Admiral Jarvis does is he ordered the Admiral who was in command of Nelson's part of the fleet to attack, to turn,
mm-hmm.
to solve this problem, basically to force the engagement with the Spanish. But for reasons that are not entirely clear, the Admiral didn't see the signal or didn't acknowledge the signal or wasn't sure what the signal was supposed to mean. We don't really know exactly how that worked. But Nelson sort of independently recognized and also probably maybe saw the signal and recognized that something had to be done. So he pulled out a line and turned the other direction. He wore out a line and ended up putting his ship right in front of the onrushing Spanish ships and stopping them and thereby bringing it to action and thereby allowing the other British ships to come into the action as well. Mm-hmm. So he didn't disobey orders. He was following his commander's intent. But it's technically true that he was not ordered to do that. He just saw the opportunity and took the initiative. And at no point would Jarvis have ever said to Nelson as he was doing this, "Oh no, don't do that," and told him to stop. You know, Jarvis recognized that this was a good thing to do and followed him in. So he didn't disobey orders, but he does make a name for himself. This is where he becomes famous, which is why it's worth spending some time on this, because Nelson ends up in the thick of the action. His ship takes a Spanish ship he boards it, which is pretty unusual in a fleet action. It's actually pretty hard to board a ship. Nelson leads a boarding party onto the Spanish ship, and then another Spanish ship comes up and gets entangled with the first Spanish ship. So then Nelson leads the same boarding party onto the next Spanish ship and manages to take two Spanish ships basically in the same move. And later after the battle, he made sure to have he supported the printing of these depictions of that action, and he called it Nelson's Patent Bridge for Boarding First Rates. And the joke is, of course, that the Patent Bridge is another first rate. So he used one ship to board another. But the only way he was able to do that was because there were, you know, half a dozen other British ships involved in the same part of the same action.
Right.
So damaged the Spanish ships that they got entangled like that. So it was a team effort for sure. Nelson took the sort of the most ostentatious action, and that he made his name for himself after that. He also made sure to tell everybody that he had done this. So he's good at PR. He is rightly famous after the end of at the end of the Battle of Cape St. Vincent.
Okay. And around this time he becomes admiral. I know what a captain of a ship does. The admiral kind of controls the whole fleet, though, that he's assigned, correct?
Yeah, so it depends on where the admiral is and whether they're in a detached command or if they're in a bigger fleet. So Nelson is promoted to admiral, rear admiral of the Blue. If he is on a detached command, and we'll see him on a detached command shortly and at the Battle of the Nile, then yeah, he's both responsible for the movement of the fleet as well as its provisioning and the tactics that it's going to employ and supervising all the officers on board. You know, there are many army equivalents that your listeners, I'm sure, can draw parallels to. But sometimes admirals serve under other admirals. In that case, they're in charge of a section of the fleet and they're in charge of a squadron or some other duty related to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, not long afterwards, he suffers a stiff loss against the Spanish at the Battle of, I'll let you pronounce it.
It's basically in the Canary Islands. Let's go with that.
Canary Islands. Can't bungle it. He's also somewhat severely wounded, too. What happened in that battle?
So the big context for this action in 1797, I think, is that in the spring of 1797, so just a couple months after the Battle of Cape St. Vincent, the great mutinies happen in April, May, June of 1797. And those are mutinies back in the home waters. So they're in the Channel Fleet and in the North Sea Squadron back in England. But they are they really shake the foundations of British naval power, because if the sailors are refusing to serve, even if the French are out, then all of Britain's strategy in the war is going to collapse around its ears and British naval power will crumble. So Nelson's in the Mediterranean at the time. He's still there after the Battle of Cape St. Vincent, and there are no mutinies in the Mediterranean squadron, but every officer is suddenly on edge that there is going to be a mutiny. And so one of the ways that Jarvis and Nelson, they diagnosed the problems of what had happened in the Channel Fleet was that the sailors hadn't been busy enough. Mm-hmm. They basically come up with any excuse they can find to keep the sailors busy. And that means coming up with, you know, legitimate military targets, but maybe not targets that would have been very high on their list before the mutinies. And so the treasure ship that's supposed to be in a harbor in Tenerife, and they decide, okay, well, Nelson, why don't you go lead from the front to show the men, you know, lead by example here, go take this treasure ship and capture the mole where the, you know, the little gun battery is, and that'll keep up morale. It'll keep us, you know, everybody loves a treasure ship. You can distribute the proceeds and that'll make people happy. And also it'll keep people busy. So that was the context for it. The operations bungled. They try to land by surprise twice, but all that does is alert the defenses. So the third time they try it, it's not a surprise. Nelson is separated from the other boats in the squadron, and he's shot in the arm just as he's trying to get out of the boat. He loses his right arm. He's lucky not to have died. It was a really close call.
Wow. So, I mean, he's already lost sight in his eye and now a right arm. He's really getting a lot of scars in his career early on.
Yeah, and remember, if you lose, one of the other things that admirals do all day is they write letters. And if you lose your right arm, then you have to learn how to write with your left hand. So it's Nelson's pretty depressed after this incident, as you can imagine. He just lost his right arm. He was defeated. It's no fun. But he has to teach himself how to write with his left hand. So there's some really fascinating letters that are in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich in England that are always worth checking out to watch Nelson teach himself how to write left-handed at the age of 40. And it's tough. He's clearly not in a good place.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's important to note that as much as we like to lionize these men, Nelson, Wellington, and Napoleon, we must remember that they're human and they had setbacks or losses in their career. So still a great commander. He's having a great career so far, but like his best moments aren't even here yet. Correct.
Right. Well, the Battle of Cape St. Vincent is up there in his career pantheon for sure. But you're right. He has his ups and downs, just like everybody else does. He doesn't win all his every action that he's involved with.
Okay. Well, on the other side of the English Channel, there's this guy named Napoleon who's kind of up and coming. He does very well in Italy. The director of government of France wants to get him away from Paris. So Napoleon and the directory come up with the idea of invading Egypt. So they head out, I think, in 1798.
Right.
And it's very secret. Napoleon and the French government kind of keep it very secret on where they're going. I think even the troops on the ships don't even know until the last moment that they're going to Egypt. Is this why Nelson has trouble locating and intercepting this expedition?
Sort of. There's a lot going on. Interestingly, there are parts of the British government that know exactly where they're going. So the British intelligence had penetrated this. You're absolutely right. It was a very secret expedition. It was not intended to tell anybody where they were going. Many of the men on board didn't know where they were going. All that's true. But the British knew, but they couldn't believe it. It was too ridiculous to be true. Why would they do that?
Right.
That was not going to Egypt was not something that made any sense to anybody. And so the British, it is a British intelligence failure in the sense that they had the right intel and they didn't act on it properly. But on the other hand, it's easy to sort of take the side of the British here and say, yeah, it is crazy to think what the French were doing. And so it's not surprising that they didn't quite believe that this would happen. So that's one reason why Nelson doesn't capture Napoleon at sea and end Napoleon's career far before it could really take off. Mm-hmm. The other reason, there are two other reasons. One is that Toulon is where the squad, that's where the expedition leaves from. And it's a very difficult place for the British to blockade. It's on the wrong side of France, right? It's in the Mediterranean. So mm-hmm. you have to deploy a squadron there and figure out where to station the squadron when it's not immediately off of Toulon, right? You need a port somewhere to resupply, to provide the provisions for the ships and to keep them in repair. Mm-hmm. And, there's nothing close by. So they try Menorca for a while, but that's got its problems. Gibraltar's pretty far away and doesn't have many resources. And they haven't gotten to Malta yet. So Toulon is a difficult place to blockade. So Nelson's job, he's detached from the Mediterranean squadron under St. Vincent and told to go figure out what this expedition is doing and stop it from happening. But it's really hard to blockade Toulon because it's a very open harbor and it's not a place that's easy to sit right off of and just keep people from coming out. So that's the second problem. And then the third problem is that Nelson's ship is dismasted in a storm the night that the expedition leaves. And it's probably not Nelson's fault. It's probably the fault of his flag captain. So admirals had captains that commanded the ship that they were on, their flagship had a captain. Mm-hmm. That person's responsible for sailing the ship. And his flag captain probably bungled it, and that caused his ship to be dismasted, because he's the other ships that he's with are not dismasted, interestingly. So it suggests that something went wrong on Nelson's ship.
Got it.
They're dismasted and they're blown away from the entrance to the harbor. So the French are able to get out of Toulon without the British figuring out where they're going. And Nelson tries to gather intelligence over the course of the next couple of weeks to try to figure out where they're going. He's got people telling him that they're going to Egypt, but he's like, you can't be serious. They must not be going to Egypt. Until he finally realizes that that's the only explanation for where he hears the French have gone. And so he decides, all right, fine. You're going to Egypt. I will go to Egypt too. And he races to Egypt. On the way there, he and the French, the British and the French squadrons pass within sight of each other, but they're misidentified, and there's they don't recognize that that's what the other squadron is. It's very hard to identify an enemy or a friendly ship at sea, and they're distant on the horizon, and they assume that it's something else when in fact it was actually the enemy. So there's a very close call. Nelson almost intercepts the French fleet at sea, and again, there's another great what if.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You just wonder, like, if he would have caught up with him and stopped him before he got to Egypt. But yeah, a great what if.
There's a great what if there. There's a great what if about he'd never let him get out of Toulon in the first place. That's two. Then the third one is that Nelson actually beat the French to Egypt. Remember that the French are carrying with them all these troops, you know, the army that Napoleon's going to, you know, ends up deploying in Egypt. And so they're not very fast sailors, and the British don't have any of that with them. So they race off to Egypt, and they arrive in Alexandria, and there's nobody there, and nobody's heard a thing about the French. And then Nelson's like, oh no, like I've blown it. I've raced to the eastern end of the Mediterranean and the French have gone somewhere else. I thought that they were coming here. Well, maybe I made a mistake. So he turns around, he heads back to the middle of the Mediterranean thinking that he's, you know, made a huge blunder. And anyways, the French sort of take an unexpected route and sort of gently and slowly, you know, land in Egypt, and everybody, all the troops get off. And Nelson then hears about this and is like, oh, they were going there after all, turns around and races back. And that's when the Battle of the Nile happens. Yeah. Yeah. After Napoleon had gotten off. So the third what if in this story is, what if Nelson had not beaten the French to Egypt, but actually met them there when they arrived? So he's basically unlucky. He does almost everything right in the, except for getting dismasted in this campaign. But it's, you know, the ocean is big. It's that's the fundamental fact in naval warfare. And it's really hard to find other enemy ships at sea. If you're at the top of the mast of Nelson's flagship on a clear day, you could maybe see 20 miles.
Right.
That's not nothing, but the Mediterranean's a lot bigger than 20 miles. So, and if you see a sail on the horizon, you don't necessarily know what that sail is. You got to get a lot closer to figure it out. So yeah, indeed, a couple missed calls there.
Well, he more than makes up for it, and he fights and wins his second most famous battle, in my opinion, the Battle of the Nile in Egypt. What was the key to this lopsided victory against the French? I've heard different things, you know, the layout that the French captain chose, or maybe Napoleon chose for the French captain. But I also think of some boldness on Nelson's part, wasn't it?
Both of those things are true. So, okay. And actually there's a third factor too, which is Nelson's lead captain, Foley in the Goliath, is the one who actually figures out that he can go inshore the French. So, for people who aren't familiar with the battle, basically the French army's ashore, and the 13 ships of the line that the French have that had escorted the troops there don't really have much of a mission at this point, because they've successfully deposited the army ashore. And so they've anchored themselves in Abukir Bay near the mouth of the Nile. And they'd anchored themselves in such a way that they thought that there was no way that the British would risk trying to get in between them and the shoals that were near the shore. So they thought the British ships would be too deep, and it would be too difficult to do that. But when Nelson realizes where the French are, he orders an immediate attack, even though it's late in the day. It's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He says, I don't care, let's go for it. And that kind of aggression also, you know, trickles down to his captains. And so the first captain in the line, Foley in the Goliath, figured out that he actually could get inshore of the French. And so he leads some captains on the inshore, and then other captains go on the outside, and they manage to double up the 12 British ships of the line double up the French the half of the fleet. And because the other ships are at anchor, and because they act cowardly, they do not come to support their colleagues in danger. And so the British are able to fire to both sides of the French ships over the course of the evening. And it results in the explosion of the 120-gun French flagship, the Lorient, and a massive explosion that sort of causes the battle to stop for half an hour where everybody picks up the pieces. But it's an astonishing British victory. They take 11 out of the 13 French ships of the line. Interestingly, one of the captains, or I guess he's an admiral already, in the two that get away is Villeneuve, who becomes Nelson's opponent at Trafalgar. So he got him there.
We'll hear that name again later. And there's one final what if, because obviously Napoleon's now stranded somewhat in Egypt, but he sneaks away later and leaves his army there, and somehow again evades the British Navy.
Yeah, and a lot of that's on Nelson, actually. So after the Nile, Nelson ends up in Naples, where he's supposed to be supporting the Neapolitan effort against French Republicans in Italy. Instead, he gets tangled up in court politics and makes a series of errors. He also meets and falls in love with Emma Hamilton, who's the wife of the British ambassador. And they end up in a really bizarre menage a trois, it's a strange story. This is where Nelson's marriage breaks down. Nelson is bitter that he wasn't sufficiently praised for his great victory at the Nile. He thought he should have been made something more than Baron Nelson of the Nile. A barony is nice, but it's not an earldom, which is what St. Vincent had gotten after the Battle of St. Vincent. So he's jealous, he's wounded, he's hurt emotionally and physically, and he's fallen in love with Emma Hamilton, and he's caught up in court politics. And while all this is happening, Napoleon decides to leave his army in Egypt and sneak back. And there's some evidence to suggest that the British knew that that was happening and were encouraging Napoleon to come back from Egypt in order to, launch the coup that he launched. But in Nelson's case, I don't think Nelson had anything to do with that other than neglecting his job of keeping the French in Egypt.
All right. Well, let's talk about that bad decision-making and the Naples controversy, where he's accused of war crimes. Can you briefly sum up what that was about?
I think the way to explain it is probably in the simplest terms. I think a war crimes accusation is a little unfair. Let's go through the facts first, and then we'll decide how guilty he is. So another officer who was in Nelson's squadron was on the spot, and he had there were some French Republican allied troops that had gotten caught in a castle, I think, near Naples, and they decided to surrender on the terms that the officer had agreed to give them, which was that they would be released and sent back to France. Mm-hmm. Nelson showed up when he got back from a patrol and canceled the agreement. But it seems like nobody really told the rebels this. So when they surrendered, they thought that they were getting safe passage back to France, but instead they were turned over to the Neapolitan forces, who executed a bunch of them. Wow. So Nelson did not execute them, but Nelson did not handle the situation with the kind of tact and insight that you would want him to have handled it with. So that's the quote unquote war crime. So I tend to think I don't think war crime is fair, but I think he did not shower himself in glory in that incident. And it was deeply unfortunate and a tragedy.
Yeah. Just, a stain on his career. Yeah. Maybe you don't call it a war crime, but it's certainly something that doesn't reflect well on him.
Right.
Well, moving along in his story, he assists in a successful siege of Malta against the French garrison there. But his personal life is kind of broken by this time, isn't it?
Yeah, he's disobeying orders from superior officers to stay with Emma Hamilton in Naples. He helps out with the siege of Malta, but I wouldn't give him too much credit there. He's generally neglectful of his responsibilities while he's in Naples. And he's so neglectful, actually, that he doesn't even take a ship home. He and Emma and William Hamilton end up going overland back to England when he's finally relieved of his embarrassing duty in the Mediterranean. So yeah, this is when he arrives back in England in I think 1800 and has a very awkward encounter with Fanny, his wife, and ends up living with Sir William and Emma in this menage a trois situation that is the great scandal of the day. And so he's in all the newspapers, and it's the, you know, poor Fanny, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, you wonder like if his ego is just too big for his britches by this point, or maybe, like you said, he just feels like he should have been more awarded and lauded with, you know, titles after his big victory at the Nile.
I think that's an accurate description of your ego being too big.
Yeah. Well, moving along the story, in 1801, he sails to the Baltic Sea and is involved in the Battle of Copenhagen in Denmark. This wasn't a lopsided one. This is more of a close call victory, wasn't it?
That's right. Nobody trusts Nelson with an independent command after what he'd done in the Mediterranean. So he's sent out as the number two. He's the second in command of the expedition. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting battle. It's hard to recreate because you need to know the ins and outs, literally, of the harbor at Copenhagen. But the general description that you gave there is right. It's a close call. Could easily have gone the other way. Nelson is an important part of the British victory, but keep in mind that he's not actually in charge of the entire expedition, and so he's not in charge of the decision to attack Copenhagen in the first place. To understand that, you need to understand the armed neutrality that Russia is trying to foment in the Baltic, which would basically turn them into enemies of Britain in practice, if not technically legally. And so the real British target of that expedition was Russia, but the commander of the expedition, Nelson's superior, does not feel confident in going all the way through Copenhagen and all the way up to Russia to actually deal with the problem, and decides instead to hit the Danes, who had sort of tentatively allied with the Russians in this armed neutrality. So that's where the battle comes from. The actual battle itself is very bloody, huge numbers of casualties on both sides. And it involves Nelson correctly identifying the weak point in the Danish defenses and leading his ships safely into a position where they could hammer at the weakest part of the Danish defenses. But this is actually where Nelson comes closest to disobeying orders for the sake of victory. And this is a funnier story, which is that the Admiral Parker gave Nelson a signal while Nelson was involved in hammering at the weakest parts of the defenses to order him, if he needed to retreat in front of the if things were going poorly. This was Parker saying, you can come back. It looks like things are going badly, so if you need to come back, here's an order that says that you can do that. But that would involve basically throwing away the victory, because Nelson would have had to bring his ships right in front of the strongest parts of the Danish defenses, at which point they probably would have lost. So Nelson is pissed that he got this order. He doesn't want to obey the order. And so he turned to his flag captain, Foley again, and he said, you know, I have only one eye and I have a right to be blind sometimes. And then he put the telescope up to his blind eye and said, I really don't see that signal. And basically all the other captains in his squadron, when they saw that Nelson didn't react to the signal and didn't repeat it, and didn't put it up on his own ship, they're like, all right, fine, let's just keep going. So is it disobeying orders? Sort of. It's more like Nelson had better tactical information than Parker did, and so he correctly judged that the order to retreat was a bad idea and he should not do it.
Got it. That was an interesting battle. I know it was quite violent, with each side suffering over 1,000 casualties. So I appreciate you giving us that overview of it. In between this battle and obviously the most famous one at Trafalgar, what is Nelson up to?
Well, he's partly responsible for repelling attempted French invasions. I say partly because he's basically trotted out as a way to reinforce public opinion and to convince them that that there's not actually a threat from the French. But then they ship him off to the Mediterranean to be the commander-in-chief. And so for the 2 years before Trafalgar, he is the commander-in-chief of the Mediterranean fleet, and his job is to guard, again, a French fleet that is preparing for sea at Toulon. Mm-hmm. Why would that have anything to do with invasion defense? Well, it turns out that Napoleon had something like 8 different plans for how to invade Britain between 1803 and 1805, and many of them involved, not all of them, but many of them involved basically sending large French naval forces all the way to the West Indies, where the British would stupidly chase them. And then while the British had chased them, rush back to Europe, where they would get temporary control of the English Channel.
Right.
The idea was suck all the British forces across the ocean and then rush back before they knew what was happening, because they were hoping to get all the French army that's encamped at Boulogne across the channel as fast as they could. But as long as the British control the channel, that wasn't going to happen. So you had to remove British forces from the channel, and this was the plan. And so the Toulon fleet was supposed to be a key part of that, that when the Toulon fleet left and raced across to the West Indies, that was supposed to drag all the British forces over to the West Indies.
Mm-hmm.
So Nelson's job was to stop that from happening.
Well, let's jump into this 1805 battle, which is, arguably his most famous one at Trafalgar. How did that battle go down, and why was it such a pivotal victory for the British?
I really want to emphasize that I have to tell you the story about the campaign at Trafalgar, because the battle itself is a weird afterthought that has very little to do with the campaign, but the campaign is the important part.
So okay.
By the campaign, we mean this attempt by Napoleon to drag British forces away from the channel so that he could get his army across it. And so the real story of Trafalgar is in the campaign. And that's when, again, Nelson fails to prevent the French from getting out of Toulon. Not his fault. It's a very difficult thing to do, but the French get out. And again, Nelson thinks they must be going east. Maybe they're going back to Egypt again. So he guards the eastern approaches to the Med to do that. But in fact, the French are going west. They go west to Spain. They pick up Spanish allies there. And then Villeneuve, who's in charge of the fleet, sails to the West Indies. Nelson figures out where Villeneuve's gone and sails to Gibraltar. He can't quite figure out what to do from there, though. Remember that Nelson is commander-in-chief of the Mediterranean, so he takes the remarkably bold decision to chase Villeneuve across to the West Indies, not in the Mediterranean. And he, so he takes his command out of the Med, races across the Mediterranean, and almost intercepts Villeneuve in the West Indies. He gets some bad intel from an American, of all people. Probably deliberately bad intel, actually. Because remember, the Americans are no friends of the British here. And misses Villeneuve in the West Indies. But nevertheless, he at least has identified where Villeneuve was. Villeneuve sails back across the ocean. Napoleon's plan seems to be working, right?
I was going to say, it seems to be working. Yeah.
But then when Villeneuve gets back to the mouth of the English Channel, he loses his nerve and he's deterred from joining up with other French fleets that are stationed there by a guy named Sir Robert Calder, who manages to scare Villeneuve off, and Villeneuve retreats into the Spanish port of Ferrol. And at that point, the campaign comes to a sort of grinding halt, that Napoleon's plans have fallen apart. Nelson goes back to the Mediterranean at that point, figuring that I guess he should probably return to wherever his command was. That was his job, after all. And Villeneuve eventually decides, I can't do this. I can't overwhelm the British in the channel. And he puts into port at Cadiz in the summer of 1805. And in the summer of 1805, at the same time, the Austrians declare war, and Napoleon up sticks from Boulogne and heads east to go fight them. And that's the Battle of Austerlitz. I have yet to mention the Battle of Trafalgar, and yet the invasion threat is over.
Right.
Nelson goes on leave in August. He goes home for the first time in 2 years. And he's like, "Woof, man, that was crazy, wasn't it?"
Yeah.
And they blockade the French and Spanish fleet in Cadiz. Nelson takes a month off. He returns to the blockade of Cadiz in, I think, September of 1805. I'm not sure if I have that date right, but close enough. And spends a few weeks getting to know the captains that he didn't know very well from because they weren't part of that fleet that had gone across the Mediterranean. And then Napoleon is so pissed at Villeneuve for having bungled the plan, for having not had the courage to press home the advantage when he had it, that he sends him an order. He's clearly going to relieve Villeneuve. Villeneuve knows this is happening, but he sends him an order to, like, I don't know, sail and go support my army in Italy is basically the order. And Villeneuve's like, all right, fine. And they leave the port in Cadiz on October 20th, 1805. And the next day, Nelson's fleet intercepts him and wins the great victory at Trafalgar. But that's an afterthought, right? That's not part of the major operations of that summer. The major operations of that summer were, the big question was, could Napoleon get across the English Channel?
Right.
And it looks like from the way the campaign shook out, the answer was he maybe could have. There's a chance it was going to work, but Villeneuve blew it. And by the time Villeneuve actually puts to sea to fight Nelson at Trafalgar, the campaign's over. Napoleon is up sticks and headed east. So it's not, it's not about Britain anymore.
Right. Well, we'll briefly touch on the battle because we do have to talk about the battle's aftermath. The two fleets were somewhat even in strength, were they not, with the French and the Spanish?
Yeah. You know,
a large number of ships against the British.
Yeah, I think it's 33 French and Spanish to 27 British. Mm-hmm. That matters a little bit, but that's roughly evenly matched in the grand scheme of things. And especially because it's hard for allies to fight together like that in a battle. So the British do have the advantage of all being on the same team, whereas the French and the Spanish have to work with each other. So Nelson sets out the plan for the battle well in advance. He anticipates where he thinks he's going to find the French fleet, the French and Spanish fleet, how they're going to be arranged. He has a good sense in advance of what he wants to do. He tells all his captains what his plan is. Mm-hmm. And, that plan is to form into two lines and approach at basically a right angle to the French and Spanish fleet, which is usually not the done thing. If you do that, you're putting yourself at risk of being raked, which is getting shot down the bow or stern of your ship. This would be very damaging, but he decides he wants to take that risk because he thinks it's the best way to force a chaotic action in which he knows that British training and gunnery will be more effective than French and Spanish training and gunnery. And he's proved exactly right in that. So it's a massive British victory. And obviously we'll talk about this in a second, but Nelson dies at the battle. He does know that he's won before he dies.
Yeah, no, it's arguably the most famous British victory at sea ever. But at the end, like you said, Nelson knows that he's winning, but he's killed by a French sharpshooter at the tail end of the battle. But he's not killed outright. What were his last moments like?
It's pretty awful. He takes a bullet in the shoulder, and it breaks his spine.
Mm.
And he knows that it's really bad by all accounts. He went below, and he knew that he wasn't going to make it. But it took about 3 hours for him to die. So there are lots of conflicting accounts about his last words. Some people think that he said, "Thank God I've done my duty." Other people think, "God and my country," something like that. So there are a lot of people that recorded those moments and talked about them after the fact. He knows he's won because by 4:30 the battle is pretty much over. His last order is to anchor the fleet because they can tell there's a swell coming in and they know that there's a big storm coming. And the storm that follows the battle actually causes almost as much damage as the battle itself does. So it's a very damaging storm that they can see coming. And those are Nelson's last moments.
Okay. Well, he dies at 47 years of age. What was his funeral like? Because I know the Duke of Wellington had a massive funeral. Was Nelson's similar?
Yeah. In some ways, simpler. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that to say it wasn't grander, but nobody had conflicted feelings about Nelson's death, I think it's fair to say. Whereas if you were not politically allied with the Duke of Wellington by the time he dies at the very grand old age of whatever it is in the 1850s, right? There were people out there who really didn't like Wellington and had very good reasons to it because he'd been a politician for 40 years, right?
Right.
So unlike that, Nelson is universally respected and praised as the great hero of the age. So his body lays in state at the Painted Hall in Greenwich for 3 days, and then it was carried by barge to St. Paul's. Hundreds of thousands of people probably saw it, all lining up to see it in sort of silent crowds. So really, if you can picture what it looks like for a couple hundred thousand people to be silent, you can imagine what this must have been like.
Yeah.
And then he's interred underneath the crossing at St. Paul's, where he still is today. So a massive state funeral, effectively the kind of thing you'd expect for a monarch, but in many ways he was more beloved.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about his legacy. I kind of want to give you the floor on this, because I mean, there's a Duke of Wellington, there's Napoleon, there's a lot of interesting, you know, King George III. There's a lot of interesting characters from this time period. But in terms of his legacy for the British Navy and for England, or, you know, the United Kingdom itself, what would you say that is?
Slightly complicated for the Victorians, who are concerned about his marital situation. So he takes his reputation suffers a little bit in the world of Victorian morality, but in pretty much every other case, he's widely praised as the greatest naval commander in British history. He deserves a lot of that credit. He clearly was a brilliant tactician. He had an intuitive understanding of how to maximize his chances of victory when he was in command of ships. He was an incredible leader of men. He inspired men in ways that are, it's hard to quantify, but we can clearly see in the textual evidence and the way they talked about him. He was an innovative tactician. So he also understood how to make the most of British advantages over the French and Spanish fleets. And, you know, you said in your notes to me before this that you were interested in talking about how relatively strong the British Navy was and whether that should detract from his brilliance. And it is true that institutionally, the British Navy is stronger than the French and Spanish opponents in the Napoleonic period. But I don't think we should take that too far. Among the reasons it's stronger is that the British Navy has Nelson. And there are many other good reasons, too. But it's not like Nelson is more than a replacement level admiral, let's put it that way. And
right.
have evidence of that from plenty of other battles at the time where opportunities were presented that were similar to opportunities that Nelson had, and the results were not as spectacular. Nelson really managed to get the most out of the men that, that were serving underneath him. So, Nelson's leadership qualities and his legacy are still widely celebrated, and I think generally correctly so. He's not somebody that I would feel too many complicated feelings about in terms of putting him up there with Napoleon and Wellington. Of course, yeah, absolutely. No question in my mind that he deserves all that. And his, you know, his personal failings were, you know, he's human. That's really to it.
Yeah, he had faults for sure. But and I appreciate your point on that. I mean, yes, the British Navy were the dominant force at sea, but were they head and shoulders above their competitors? I don't know.
They were in some respects and not in others. So, in terms of shipbuilding, for example, the French and Spanish managed to get more ships at sea than the British do. The British have a different manning system, so that has both pros and cons. Their logistics are clearly superior to the French and Spanish. That's one of the areas of key strength. And tactically, they seem to have been more aggressive and more willing to focus on killing men rather than damaging ships, which generally was a better way to go about fighting a fleet battle. So, the British Navy was, I think, head and shoulders above the French and Spanish at the time, but that shouldn't, I think, diminish too much from Nelson's accomplishment for sure. And the Spanish Navy is probably the underrated partner in there. I think the Spanish Navy was a really well-run generally organization, especially in the 1790s, and was a viable foe for a lot of the British fights in the period. But I think Nelson managed to capitalize more on British strengths than many of his peers did. And that's worth something.
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you for that, Evan. I appreciate it. That was, I really learned a lot in that episode, and hopefully my listeners did as well. The book, again, if you want to check out The Horrible Peace by Evan, about British veterans post 1812 and post Waterloo, please check it out. And we appreciate you joining the show.
Thanks for having me.